this angel just came into my life. I call him my angel. And this was the coach who would go on to coach me for the next probably 14 months of my life. And this was the man that was the first person to really get me to see how limited my viewpoint of myself and what I thought was possible for me in my life was, and to really help me start to understand my self-sabotaging behaviors and those self-limiting beliefs.
Hey, welcome back to the Ultramarathon Mindset Podcast, where we talk about what it takes to go the distance in running and in life. I'm your host, Eric Dieter. I'm an ultramarathon runner and a mindset coach. When trail runners get together to run a few miles, we never know where the conversation is going to go. So if you're ready, let's get started. Hey, I'm glad you are here. I am excited about this week's show. My guest this week is Tara Bianca. She is the owner of Be Light Transformative Therapy. She's worked in the past as a personal trainer and a massage therapist, and she is presently a certified breathwork instructor with the Oxygen Advantage. And we talk a lot about personal transformation and also how breathwork can help runners or anybody interested in better health. It was a very, very packed conversation. A lot of things in here that I really, really enjoyed. And I hope you enjoy my conversation with Tara Bianca. You know, they always said life is not a sprint, it's a marathon.
Yeah.
There's so many people running marathons now. It's like, no, that's too easy.
Yeah, for sure.
But the ultramarathon is definitely. In fact, there was a YouTube film called, it was called Life in a Day, and it was about a 100-mile race out in California, and they ran it in 24 hours, and I talked to and kind of followed that trend, as you start out, you're fresh and everything, and then you get to those points where it's like, oh my goodness, you know, I can't go on.
Oh yeah, I bet.
And so tell me a little bit about your where you're at as far as, I see you making videos,
the videos right now are content.
Yeah,
the videos right now are my ultramarathon. It's my version of your podcast. I feel like you and I, Eric, have been on a similar kind of trajectory over the last year and a half. It sounds like, I own a company called Be Light Transformative Therapy, and my vision for that company has always been in my mind when I first conceived of it to be a global online holistic health network that brings together experts from all over the world, from all different modalities, everything from the most scientifically evidence-based science to the most spiritual esoteric philosophies, and just really bringing our heads together as opposed to having this more typically combative of like modern medical paradigm versus holistic health, you know, and always kind of clashing with each other. It was really always designed to be this really integrative experience for people, bringing a lot of free education, a lot of free self-help tools, a lot of tools for instant implementation to make people's quality of life better. And what happened when I formed that company formally is I was still just kind of like a private practitioner in my little office in Manhattan, working with people one-on-one, you know? So I had the vision, but it wasn't manifesting yet. And that's fine. I loved being a practitioner for so many years. You know, I had an office in Manhattan for about 16 years working with people one-on-one. And my bread and butter was really mostly manual therapy all those years. I was a personal trainer for a long time and mostly a massage therapist, a lot of osteopathic techniques and that kind of stuff. And then in March of 2020, I just had to shut down completely. And as traumatic as that was and how scary it was to have a complete loss of income and salary, I am really one of those people that feels absolutely blessed from this massive transition and this massive change, because it's forced me finally to move into this direction, which was my initial intention. And now I feel much closer to that original dream than I ever did. So Be Light today in this moment is really now getting more connected with this global experience of teaching people holistic health tools around the world. So the programs I run now pull students from all over India, all over America, from South America. You'll get people in Australia, Hawaii sometimes, so all over Europe. So that's very cool. And it really just warms my heart to know that just having the courage to shift gears and take a chance and try something different and put myself out of my comfort zone has resulted in this amazing connective experience with people around the world. And I just feel really blessed in this moment. It definitely has a lot of room for growth still. We're still in the very infant stages, but I really see that it's only going to keep growing and expanding in that way. So I'm just so, so grateful right now.
That's cool. So, I mean, I'm going to go double check. I'm going to make sure I heard what you said. You had the vision for the global outreach before, but you were stuck in your local.
I was stuck in it.
Doing one-on-one. So,
yeah.
So what was when you were in that? I mean, tell me a little bit about what was going on in your mind as you had this big dream and you were doing the practical safe right. thing.
Well, I know this is your specialty, right? So maybe
the reason I ask it that way is like that describes so many of us. I mean, my ex-brother-in-law wanted to be a ski instructor or an artist. I can't remember. He had
those are two very different things, Eric.
I can't remember the story. I'm sorry. I know he talked about both. But you know, his high school guidance counselor says, "Well, no, you can't make money doing that, and you know, you should do something practical." And his mom and everybody. So he ended up being a lawyer, and he hated it. And he still probably hates it. I mean, I don't know. What you described was kind of a typical path for a lot of us.
I think that's one of the most crushing things we can say to our friends or our children is like, well, there's no money in that. You know, it's so soul crushing. It's so like, it puts the lid on the, you know, it puts the ceiling on where you cannot expand outside of it. And then you just feel like, oh, I'm a good boy or I'm a good girl if I stay within this box and I do what I'm supposed to do, quote unquote, and I kind of like stay on this path that seems more safe and more secure. And now my parents or like people older than me can look at me and say, I'm responsible and I'm doing the right thing. But in the meantime, you're kind of miserable and you feel like you have more to offer and you're not really making the steps to do it, you know? So it's interesting. When I first came up with the concept for Be Light, it was coming off of working for about a year with a personal coach who I consider sort of my angel. He was the first one to crack my mind open, you know, sort of helped me to see outside of my self-limiting beliefs and all of the self-sabotaging behavior and all of the small thinking and all of the, maybe some of your listeners can relate to this, or maybe you can relate to this. You know, I come off of decades of just having the lowest self-worth and really struggling with that piece about other people's judgment of me, fear of criticism, always wanting to hide, always wanting to protect myself. My defense mechanism was to always stay quiet. Don't be seen. Don't be heard. And it's so stifling to your life. I mean, it just is crushing. You can never expand when you're in that space. And so it really takes someone to show you that those beliefs were handed to you, you know, maybe even before the age of 6. They just got into your subconscious and they just turned from a seed into a massive tree. And now you identify so strongly as that being your self-identity, as that being you. But all of that garbage, all of those beliefs and the judgments and the perceptions and the emotions and even the past trauma to some degree, it's just separate. I mean, it's just like the garbage that's filling up this physical vessel and this mind, whatever we call a mind, but it's totally separate from whatever your core essence is. And I really believe that. And I know it for a fact now because I've been able to shift it 180. And a lot of that garbage doesn't exist inside of me anymore, you know? And when I look back at myself, I can't even relate to the person that I was. You know, I can't even believe that I had those feelings about myself or such low self-worth or such fear of judgment. And so what I have noticed in my own journey is when I finally find the courage to make a big step, to take a big action, everything starts to fall into place, you know, and that fear just dissipates because now you're in movement. Now you're in action. You're getting small things to kind of fuel the, like a positive reinforcement that you're on the right track. And it just keeps pushing you forward step by step, bit by bit. You know, it's not always huge successes. It can be little tiny successes, and it keeps driving you forward until all of that stuff doesn't affect you anymore. And I really had to go through that process. You know, I'm kind of grateful that I was stuck in my rut a little bit longer than I was, because I know I wasn't yet prepared for where I am now. Back then, mm-hmm. I needed to go through a little bit more of the internal work, if that makes sense. You know, so I can think back, maybe even like 7 years ago. I'm also an anatomy and physiology educator. And so I used to teach once in a while at one of the massage schools in Manhattan. And I remember it was my first year teaching for the school, and the director of the education department simply asked me for a biopic to go with the information around what I would be teaching. And Eric, I kid you not, just her asking for a picture that might be on the internet, tears started falling out of my eyes. I was so horrified of the thought of someone on the internet seeing my picture, judging me without me being able to control the environment, not knowing what they're thinking of me, not knowing what they're going to say. And I actually refused to give this woman a picture for the description of my class that I was teaching. And I look back at that now and I'm like, you were so ridiculous. That was so deep. That was like, you were so wounded by this fear of judgment. And coming from that place 7 years ago, now, you know, I have hundreds of videos on my YouTube channel. People leave nasty comments all the time, and I go with the flow. It's fine. I usually comment back and try to have like a little bit of a interaction with them and see if we can smooth things over. And I know I would have never been able to handle that 5, 6, 7 years ago. And now I'm equipped to handle it with a very light heart and with a very open mind, and realize that people have different perspectives, different perceptions. We all come at something with our own facade, with like the judgment and all the veil of judgment and different beliefs. And it just is what it is. You know, you're just interacting and you're bouncing off ideas and you're bouncing off behaviors. And there's so much mirroring and transferring of internal environments onto other people. So yeah, I don't know if I answered your question, and I feel like I'm way off topic.
I think I don't even remember what the question was. So I think we're good. But I did want to ask something in relationship to that. I know the, you know, having dealt with subconscious limiting beliefs that are so deeply rooted, I know that there's not an easy answer, but kind of what was the process you went through to get started? Because a lot of times in my case, I was able to identify where the beliefs came from, how they got there, what they were doing to me, and all, and I was unable to do anything about it. So what was the where did you get started to actually make some progress to change those beliefs? Because those, a lot of people never get to that point where, you know, they can do anything about it.
I hear you 100%. In fact, I see it all the time, because once you go through it, you can recognize it in others so much more easily, right? It's been a long journey, Eric. It wasn't like an overnight thing, and
I'm not asking you to give. I'm not asking you to make it sound easy, but the thing, I mean, what I say, you know, the first step is to, you know, make a decision, and the second is to start. And so, yeah. I mean, kind of, I was asking where did you make the decision, and how did you start making some progress?
Yeah. So I'd say back in 2015, I also had a massive injury. 2014, 2015, I had a really bad injury in my SI joint. Maybe your runners can relate to SI joint injury. I'm not sure. And so that's sort of like where the pelvis joins up, where the hip joins up with the lumbar spine, right?
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And as a manual therapist, I have very physical work that I do. And as an independent contractor, you know, you don't get sick days. You don't get time off for good behavior. You don't get a paid vacation. And so a lot of times you force yourself to work even when you shouldn't be, even when you should be focused on rest and recovery.
Yes.
So that year I was just dragging around this like gimpy leg with me everywhere I go, constant nerve pain, almost 24 hours a day. And in that place, still having to give this nurturing therapeutic care to my clients. And I was just like, what am I doing? It really was like, oh my God, I just felt like I'm giving. I'm not taking care of myself, and I'm not like getting anywhere in life. I'm really stuck in this. And I decided that, you know, I'm New York City based, and I decided, you know, I've been so tired of this environment so long. I need a massive change. And so the first step was I decided I needed a break from New York. And once I found the courage to do that, everything started to shift. So, you know, that winter, I was like, I can't go through another New York winter, especially dragging my leg around like this, I'm not going to survive. So I actually went down to Miami for about 6 months and I was working down in Miami. But I had the beach and the sun and the ocean air, and it just felt like a healthier environment for me at the time. And I kid you not. So that was a big decision for me, though. You know, I have bills to pay back in New York. I don't know if I can afford to live in two places at once. There was a lot of things that I had to work out logistically. But just in making that decision and moving down there and putting it into action, right? Action is so critical with all of this manifestation stuff and changing your patterns and wanting the life that you dream of but can't seem to get there. Action always. Just keep taking actions. Keep taking actions. So probably the third day that I was down in Miami, this angel just came into my life. I call him my angel. And this was the coach who would go on to coach me for the next probably 14 months of my life. And this was the man that was the first person to really get me to see how limited my viewpoint of myself and what I thought was possible for me in my life was, and to really help me start to understand my self-sabotaging behaviors and those self-limiting beliefs. So I think when I took action, that's when it started. And then with him, I mean, I did a lot of work. I mean, homework every night for months and months and months. A lot of probably what you've gone through. I read a little bit about your bio, so I think we have a similar kind of process, but just tracking it back. Okay, I have this fear of judgment. Where does it come from? And just every memory from my current age back to the earliest possible memory I can have around this idea of judgment, writing it down, getting clear on it. Who was in the room? Who said what to you? How did it make you feel at the time? What emotional decision did you make when you heard that sentence? And how did it get planted in your subconscious mind? And how has it precipitated all of your behaviors, all of your decisions since then? Mm-hmm. And that's a lot of work because you really have to pull yourself out of your body and kind of look as the witness onto everything that you've ever done, every decision you've ever made, all the behaviors that you're so accustomed to making, those automatic behaviors that you don't even think about. It's a lot of effort. And so it took just a lot of self-reflection, a lot of practice, a lot of two steps forward and one step back, a lot of thinking, oh, I got this now. And then realizing, oh, nope, there's that pattern again. I screwed up again. Yeah. And you know, and trying not to get discouraged by it and realizing that you're onto something. And every once in a while, taking a moment to reflect on how far you've come on the journey. You know, I think it's really useful to say, well, how would you have responded in that situation 2 years ago? And realizing, oh, wow, you know, I really handled that so much better now than I would have 2 years ago. Wow, I can really see myself changing. The other thing that helps me is, you know, when you meet new people and you hear how they reflect back to you, how you are as a person. So when I meet people now and I hear the positive things they have to say about me, I realize people from 5-10 years ago would have never made that compliment about me. You know, like there's just totally different feedback about how you are seen by others. And so it makes me know I'm presenting myself to the world in a different way. And oh, wow, by the way, my whole self-image has shifted. You know, it's piece by piece. I mean, but I think always action is the facilitator. You can't let the fear stop you.
And it sounded like you weren't really aware of how deep those limiting behaviors. So part of what you started was an awareness
is key. And,
hey,
and
I've got some things to work on.
If you want to talk about it later with breathing too, that's everything. Awareness is always the first piece for any new habit you want to bring into your life, right? You have to recognize what the current habit is or what the current pattern is if you hope to make any sort of change. Otherwise, you're just flying blind. You know, there's no reference point. The awareness was so key. In fact, it's so funny because when I met that coach, you know, he's like a very metaphysical guy. We have a lot of conversations about quantum physics and that kind of stuff, you know, like, and I can remember before I really got hooked into working with him, I mean, it shows you where I was in my mind and in my belief system. I used to see my friends reading these self-help books and these spiritual books. And I was like, oh my God, this is such nonsense, you know? And like the more they read them, I'd be like, why are you bothering? You don't change anything. Nothing ever seems to change. Why are you reading this book? You know? So I was really stuck in that cynical, negative viewpoint around that entire line of healing and that entire line of thinking and sort of self-improvement and personal growth. And it wasn't until I found this person to really grab me and see the potential in me. And I have to give him a lot of gratitude for that because I didn't necessarily come willingly. He saw something and he kind of proposed this idea to me. So, you know, I'm really cool. grateful for that. That's it cool. takes sometimes it takes someone else to see it in you that it's possible to change, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. And I was one of those guys who was reading all those self-help books. And never changing.
Yeah. And, I mean, I think it's so common that that happens. So too many of us, like you said, it's like because some people who are reading those books are going through the same thing that you just said a moment ago of, okay, well, I can recognize that I have a problem with this, but how do I shift it? How do I make the change? I think the how is often what's missing from those books, you know?
Well, and they put the how in there, but it never worked. I mean, I did the how and I was like, no, that didn't work. And so, yeah. Yeah, I just stayed stuck. So,
yeah, I hear you.
So, how did you get into breath? I originally wanted to have you to come and talk to my audience about breath work. And so, yes. This mindset stuff is so. If anyone who's listening, I mean, this all bonus. So, because I stumbled onto Patrick McEwen, and actually, it was a video from a runner. A coach, and he had running videos, and he talked about why you're out of breath when you run. And I was like, yeah, let's you know, because I was out of breath when I ran, and it's like, okay, sure. if I can learn something. And so he referenced Patrick McEwen's book. I read that, I read Breath by James Nestor. And, yep. I was like, yeah, there's a whole lot of, I was breathing through my mouth. You know, anytime I would do something physical, you know, run, anytime I ran, I always breathe through my mouth, just because it made sense. Like I could get more air in, and it just, I tried breathing through my nose. It didn't feel like I got enough. And so, so I read his book, and then I found, and I saw you, I was doing some work on for my coaching clients about doing a little bit of breath work and as far as instruction and resonant breathing. And then I found you online and I was like, wow, you've been trained on the Oxygen Advantage. And I said, I want to find out what you can say about breathing. Because you know, all I know is what I've read. And so I want somebody who's got some deeper knowledge. So.
Definitely. Well, I mean, so tell me a little bit about this big topic.
Well, I know. Tell me. I mean, you've said a little bit about where you were. What was it that sparked you to say, I need to learn how to teach about breathing?
Yeah, you know, so as a holistic practitioner, you know, so I've been in holistic health for probably almost 20 years, and I have studied a lot of different modalities. And for me, breathing has always kind of been coming in the periphery, you know, in sort of like my peripheral view. And I kind of wanted to know more, but couldn't find the right teachers, or it just wasn't really omnipresent as it's becoming now. And it was hard to kind of get a grasp on it. But, you know, I've definitely done a lot of yoga in my life. I used to do a lot of Qigong and Tai Chi. So there's always this breath element that's coming up, right? And you hear sort of from the ancient practices in particular, you hear them always mentioning the breath, not always with a lot of specificity. And sometimes the wording is a little too poetic to really understand it concretely in a Western mindset, you know? But it was always there and always about this idea of lining up the breath with the movement, or let the movement come from the breath, not the opposite way, right? Mm-hmm. Let the breath be the leader. And it's like, okay, but it's kind of like the self-help books. It's like, okay, but how? And like, okay, and what is that actually doing? You know? And so you start digging and you realize some people are teaching from tradition, but don't have a lot of answers as to the why. And I was getting pretty frustrated. And then in my manual therapy practice, I do a lot of classes on just mobilizing the diaphragm, working on the respiratory muscles more physically, more actively, and also doing kind of like active release or stretches with my clients around the diaphragm, the rib cage, all those things to try to improve respiration. So I always knew it was a thing, but I felt like I was doing a little bit of guesswork for a long time. And then, you know, in the last 5 years, I'd say, I more actively started really seeking out teachers. And it started more from the spiritual side of the spectrum, honestly, Eric. You know, it's just easier to come by, or I found anyway, what was coming into my sphere of perception was teachers teaching breath work, but more from a spiritual perspective.
Mm-hmm. Well, and from what I've seen in, you know, breath work isn't ancient. I mean, but for a lot of it, it was tied up into whatever spiritual practices and beliefs that culture had.
Absolutely. In fact, you know, it's like I was just mentioning this to someone the other day because I was looking at this old abbey in Normandy, and I was thinking, like, it's out in the middle of the ocean, right? You have to climb stairs up and down. They're growing their own food. And I was like, all the medicine was built into the religion. All the medicine was built into the spiritual practice, right? There was like good circadian rhythm, eat your own food, get the microbiome from the food that you're planting, you know, like doing your exercise every day. You got to climb stairs, you got to garden, you got to take care of the abbey. And then the chanting or the singing or the mantras, whatever tradition it is, you're working on your breathing. You're working on stimulating the vagus nerve, which is what happens when we do gentle throat activation work, things like humming, things like chanting, things like gentle breathing. So I just think it's so interesting that you can't separate spirituality from health in many ways. You know, it's so built into the practice. It's really the medicine. So, you know, I think that that resonates with a certain demographic. And that is certainly what how I first came into breathwork. And the first teacher I studied with, you know, she was speaking that language of metaphysics that I was already accustomed to working with my coach, you know? And so it really resonated with me at the time because her whole thing was releasing old emotional trauma, shifting your patterns, shifting the self-limiting beliefs, getting rid of the self-sabotaging behavior, really allowing yourself to shine, to like expand upward and outward, you know, and really understanding your full potential and taking action toward it. And so I was like, whoa, you sold, you know, like let's work
as,
with this for
this
a
was
while.
This was as part of her breathwork practice.
Yeah,
wow, okay.
Exactly. That's so cool. She does a lot of affirmations, a lot of mindset work with the breathing, you know? And so I was like, okay, this is cool. And it's cool up until a point. And then, you know, it has a limitation. You know, I believe that we are a different being every single day that we get out of bed. And sometimes we're a different being across the 24-hour period, you know? So, you know, the cells are constantly changing. The mind is constantly changing. The energy level is constantly changing. The nervous system is constantly fluctuating. You're a different person at different times, and you are going to resonate with and require different modalities or techniques or self-care tools at different times. So I don't believe that the practices you take on today are necessarily going to serve you for the next 10, 20 years. There's going to be an evolution just like there is with everything, right? So that work did serve me for a while. And I used to do that work with private clients too and in group workshops. And it was fun and enlightening and people had amazing experiences. But it was very clear to me that it was really about the emotional release more than it was about some kind of physiological optimization. And because I have that background, I was a dancer, I was a gymnast, and I was a fitness trainer for a long time. So huge part of me still loves the sciencey stuff, the real concrete anatomy and physiology stuff. I want to know the why. Like, I like to know the why. So I really wanted to find breath work that was more based in pure human physiology and anatomy and had a good amount of either medical backing or scientific evidence behind it so that we could really say, this is why it's happening. So that when you teach someone something, you can give them that strong why. You know, I think it's so important. You know, some people just want a quick exercise and they don't want to know anything about it. They just, you tell them to do it, they're going to do it. And that's okay. But I think the majority of people, for it to be lasting and effective, really need to understand what is happening in my body. What can I expect to feel? You know, what is the expected outcome? And then they know what to look for and they're excited about it. And it gets them jazzed to kind of practice, you know, and be consistent with it, knowing that they're going to have this room for improvement, measurable improvement. So that was important to me. And that's how I stumbled across Patrick. You know, I've read all the books too. And I just resonated with what Patrick was saying. And I'm so glad I did. You know, the Oxygen Advantage community on the whole is a really great community of breath coaches, very giving people. We share a lot of information. We come from all different backgrounds. And so it's just really nice to have, again, that integrative experience, compare experiences, share knowledge, share anecdotal evidence about what's happening with clients. And Patrick himself is just really supportive. You know, he's not territorial about the brand. He really wants people to spread the word about better, more functional breathing. And so I just really appreciate that about him.
So, and I know that the breath work that, you know, you talk about, there's a lot of different ways to go about that. But I kind of came into it from a perspective of trying to be a better runner. And so since, you know, my audience is a lot of runners. Talk a little bit about what can we as especially endurance athletes. I mean, and so some of the people are, you know, that I talk to are, you know, in triathlon, some of them are cyclists. But so really looking at, you know, how can I make my body, you know, give myself the optimum endurance to do do things that are, most people would consider crazy.
100%. I think it's a great question. And I think there's so many little things, you know, and maybe some of your viewers have already kind of optimized on this, but let's talk about some basics. You know, so the oxygen is our energy, right? It's our source of everything. And so as endurance athletes, you guys who are going hundreds of miles, you know, you're like going above and beyond what humans ever thought was capable of, which is awesome. You're already like crushing the limits and blowing up the self-limiting beliefs, which I just admire so much. So how do you take in oxygen most efficiently? How are you going to optimize your breathing? So in the oxygen advantage, from our viewpoint, we focus on a couple things. Most concretely for this topic, nasal breathing as much as possible all the time. And mm-hmm. I'll get back into it in a minute. And the other thing tied into that is this concept of CO2 tolerance, which is pretty fashionable nowadays to talk about. So maybe some of your listeners have heard that term thrown around a bit. But that's basically how well does your body allow CO2 to elevate in the blood without getting stressed out, without feeling anxious, without feeling breathless, without feeling scared, right? And we can mm-hmm. talk a little bit more in a minute about why CO2 creates that response. And so, a lot of this is going to be, again, around shifting patterns and shifting your perception of the feelings you're experiencing in your body. That's going to be huge. So how do we get there? Step one is breath awareness, right? You're running. Like you said, almost any exercise you used to go into, you'd open your mouth immediately, right? Mm-hmm. Now, other runners, maybe they can go a good amount of time before they start opening their mouth. So number one is notice if your mouth is open or closed. And if you're able to keep your mouth closed for a good amount of time, what is it that causes you to shift to mouth breathing all of a sudden? Did your heart rate just go way up? Are you just like reaching your end tolerance in terms of your endurance right now? You know, what is happening in your body? What are you feeling? Are you uncomfortable? You know, have you hit a pain threshold in some way? You know, what is happening that made you convert to mouth breathing, right? Mm-hmm. So I think that's number one, breath awareness. Number two, then, once you have that awareness, how can you train yourself more now? Okay, maybe I want to practice breathing nasally the whole run. So now this is what we were talking about before in the journey of self-discovery and self-improvement is sometimes it's two steps forward, one step back, or sometimes mm-hmm. it's two steps back to go one step forward. And I'm going to tell you guys listening right now, converting fully to nasal breathing, if you haven't been doing it, is going to feel hard at first. You know, like it's a challenge. First of all, you have to get past the mental. Your whole life, maybe you've been breathing decades, mouth breathing, running, and you don't even have a strong why for converting to nasal breathing. Okay, so that could be one thing.
That was me a year ago. I mean, I'll say that. Totally me a year ago.
Yeah. Number two is when you first start using the nose with a greater physical exertion. You know, some people have actual blockages. Some people might have a deviated septum. Some people might have what we call a hypertrophied turbinate. So that maze-like structure inside your nose, some people have an inflamed turbinates, and it causes discomfort if they breathe in and out of their nose, or they just feel like they're suffocating. They really can't get the air in. So there can be physical things to overcome. So you have to kind of get your mind and body around, why am I going to do this? And is it going to be worth the pain and struggle? And is it going to be worth potentially deconditioning for a month or two until I can start to really get efficient at this new thing? Mm-hmm. So for anyone who's looking to try it, you just got to go into the mindset, okay, maybe the first 2 or 3 months are going to suck. I might get a little bit worse, a little bit slower, but is it going to be worth it in the long run? So then the next thing to consider is how are you going to go about doing it, you know? So the key is, you know, we say in the oxygen advantage, your breathing is only functional if you take it with you into your daily activities, your physical exercise, and into sleep. So I like to get people out of this idea of sitting down and doing a 10 to 15 minute breath practice, quote unquote, right? And then going about their day and not thinking about their breath ever again. Mm-hmm. There's value to it. But if you really want to make this a lifestyle change, it needs to be reinforced continuously throughout the day. So you know, I was a dancer and my aunt was a tap teacher. And so we used to do a lot of rhythmic stuff with our feet, right? And she used to get nuts with us when we'd all speed up and try to do things fast right away, right? She would always say, you can't do it fast until you can do it slow. And the same thing with breathing. You can't take it into your physical exertion, your sport, unless you are doing it at rest perfectly. It has to be functional at rest for it to translate into your sport, okay? So step one, breath awareness all day. How are you breathing when you're sitting at your computer, when you're driving, when you're going to the grocery store, when you're eating dinner? Are you nasal breathing all day in and out through your nose? Why is nasal breathing so important? Maybe that's the key thing that we need to drive home today, right?
Yeah, a lot of people would say, well, my mouth is bigger.
Yeah, right, so bigger is always better, folks. So that's a good point. So the mouth is bigger, but now what is happening? The mouth is bigger. I have less resistance to breathing, and that air is just pouring into my mouth directly into my lungs. And so what is the disadvantage there? The mouth doesn't have a filtration unit, right? So more prone to infection, more prone to pathogenic invaders that you can't fight off. You know, there's nothing to deter potentially pathogenic microbes from coming into the mouth. They just go straight into the lungs. Now, evolutionarily speaking, kind of historically speaking, and you can see this in other species too, particularly predatory animals. But if you go back really early on to more early humans, mouth breathing is more associated with a stress response in the body, right? With a sympathetic fight or flight response. It's usually more associated with upper chest breathing too, which means not really getting the full rib cage to expand, not really fully using the diaphragm as well as you could be. And so your brain still today, even if you're seated and your mouth is hanging open and you're breathing shallowly in upper chest, it's sending this continual subtle stress response to your brain, this subtle response of, I have something to be afraid of, or I have something to run away from, or I have something to hide from. You know, and it's subtle, but this is what keeps a lot of us stuck in chronic anxiety for so long. We're not aware of how we're breathing at rest and how that's constantly hyper-facilitating the nervous system and perpetuating this fight or flight response all day, just on this low-grade level. So that's one issue with the mouth. It's more associated naturally with a sympathetic response. And now you certainly need some sympathetic response to get your body moving, right? It's not that a stress response is always bad. We need it. But you guys in particular who are running 100 miles, you got to pace yourself. You don't want to be stressed for 100 miles. In fact, you want to be as relaxed as you can and really breathing as efficiently as possible if you're going to make it with the least amount of pain and have the best chance of recovery and not being prone to injury. So the other reason the mouth is a big problem is that it can't warm or humidify the air either, right? Your nose, you know, it looks small on the outside, but there's so much going on inside the skull. There's all these different structures that the air has to flow through. We have these turbinates that I was saying before, which increase surface area and make it harder for the air to just go directly into the lungs. You know, it's more of this winding road. The air has to take its time. And while it's doing that, it's getting warmed up. It's getting humidified. Those mucosal layers in your nose are catching any potentially pathogenic molecules and gathering them so that they don't invade the interior part of your lungs, right? The interior part of your respiratory tract. And so all of that is gone during mouth breathing. So especially depending on your geography, if I'm taking huge gasps of cold, dry air into my mouth with this heaving upper chest, I'm bringing all of this cold, dry air into the respiratory tract, and it actually causes a lot of trauma to the upper respiratory tract. Most specifically, it causes vasoconstriction, meaning your blood vessels just really start to tighten down. And even more importantly, it can cause a lot of bronchoconstriction, meaning the bronchi and the tubes of the respiratory tract start to shut down. So you're opening your mouth to try to get more air in, but paradoxically, that's shutting down your airways and preventing the air from coming in. And so that actually is the definition of exercise-induced asthma. A lot of times that's what's happening. And almost always when you can get people who suffer with exercise-induced asthma to switch to nasal breathing, those symptoms completely go away because their airways are able to stay open and they're able to take in that conditioned air and it's not traumatizing the upper airways and causing this inflammatory response and this constrictive response. So nose breathing is important. Some of the other reasons, if you want to continue, if you're exhausted talking about the nose, we can stop. You know, I think nasal nitric oxide is a hot topic right now. I think people hear about nitric oxide quite a bit. And so we mostly produce that in the nose. The mouth produces a little bit, but it's almost negligible in terms of its influence on respiration. The nose produces a lot, I think about 50 to 200 parts per billion or something like that, whereas the mouth might produce maybe 10 parts per billion. So it's a big difference. And as this, so this nasal nitric oxide is getting released all the time from what we call your paranasal sinuses. So you could imagine those are like empty holes in the cheeks next to your nose, and then also in the nose itself. And so as you slowly take an inhale in through your nose, you're pulling that nasal nitric oxide that's constantly getting released deep into the lungs, right? When nasal nitric oxide hits the lungs, it does something that we call perfusion, which means it distributes the blood in your lungs more evenly. So if you can imagine, if you're standing upright or sitting upright all day, gravity's kind of pulling the blood in your lungs into the lower lobes. It's not evenly dispersed throughout the entire lung. Mm-hmm. And the key issue with this is that those little alveoli in your lungs, so your alveoli are those little air sacs at the end of your respiratory tract, they are in charge of gas exchange, right? They're in charge of oxygen coming in, CO2 going out. If those little air sacs don't have access to blood, they ain't doing their job. They can't participate in gas exchange. And the same goes for ventilation, for air. If those little air sacs, those alveoli, don't have access to air, they cannot do their job, right? So gas exchange isn't happening. And at a foundational level, the primary reason we are breathing is for gas exchange, right? If gas exchange isn't happening, why are we breathing?
Right. Yeah.
Right.
that's the whole purpose. Yeah. And right. And for runners, you want that to happen as efficiently as possible.
Right. So you want to optimize that. And so the nitric oxide is critical because it allows as many alveoli as possible to have access to an air supply and a blood supply so that as many of them as possible are participating in gas exchange. So nasal breathing really does trump mouth breathing. Now, there are limits. When you start going into real anaerobic mode or high intensity exercise, there may be a point when you got to switch to mouth breathing. And that's because you need to meet the metabolic demands, right? Mm-hmm. But as endurance runners, again, it's like your metabolic demands hopefully are pretty consistent along the whole thing or you're not going to make it, right? So you don't want to breathe more than your metabolic needs because you're going to waste energy. You want to get your breathing to match perfectly with your metabolic needs. And so overbreathing, I find, is one of the biggest issues. And so why is that an issue? Because if you think about the act of breathing itself, it requires energy, right? Mm-hmm. So your diaphragm needs its own blood supply, needs its own oxygen supply, needs to produce ATP, all those things that your quads and your calves and everything else need for your run, right? So now you've got competition between the diaphragm and the leg muscles, right? So if you're breathing inefficiently, your body is always going to give preferential treatment to the heart, to the respiratory muscles, right? It will rob your legs, which you need to run. It will rob your legs of that blood and oxygen supply to feed the respiratory muscles because it takes priority in the body, right? Everything in the core always takes priority over the peripheral limbs.
Right, yeah. That's why you get frostbite on your hands.
Exactly. You get it 100%. So that's the big deal in terms of the efficiency. And that's why it's great to switch to nose. So there's a great study that we cite all the time. And if you want me to send you a link to it at some point after the interview, I can do that for you. Maybe your readers will be interested in it. But where they took this, it was a small study. So you can't extrapolate everything from it, but it's a nice example. They took this small group of elite runners specifically, and they tested them on all their kind of like VO2 max tests, right? And they ran them through everything, exclusively mouth breathing though. They did all their tests mouth breathing and all their runs mouth breathing. And then they said, okay, we're going to take the same group of athletes and for 6 months, we're going to force them to do all of their training nasal breathing. And in the study, they were super excessive about it. They literally like taped the mouths shut so they could not breathe through their mouths, right? So they were really forcing nasal breathing, which is not my first recommendation for everyone listening. You want to take it gradually and go at your pace. But in this study, they taped the mouths shut and these runners were doing all of their training for 6 months nasal breathing. And at the end of 6 months, they ran all of those tests again, the original tests they had done 6 months earlier, but they did all the tests nasal breathing instead of mouth breathing. And some of the things that came out of that were that they were able to do the same workload, meaning run the same distance, or sometimes faster, or sometimes more, but with 22% less breathing, which means 22% more breathing efficiency. What does that look like? That means I can do the same amount of work, breathing at a reduced respiratory rate, meaning fewer breaths per minute. And I can do that same amount of work with a reduced breathing volume, meaning I don't have to breathe in and out so much air, which takes so much energy and so much time. I can take smaller breaths and fewer of them and still achieve the same goal. They were also finding that, and if you want to interrupt at any point, Eric, please.
That's okay. And, you're on a roll. I was going to, but we passed it. So that's good.
Sorry. I may come back to a question
okay. I had.
Okay. So then some of the other things that came out of that study is that they were also seeing that, they can test the expired amount of CO2 from the body. That's how they test CO2 in the blood. And they were showing that the end-tidal CO2 was much higher than typically. And this just shows a huge adaptation to CO2 tolerance.
Say that again. You said the end.
Yep. It's called end-tidal CO2.
Okay, and that was a term I didn't quite understand. So.
Yeah. So this is like the amount of CO2. They test it through something that you blow out of. This is the amount of CO2 that's expelled from the lungs when they test it. Okay. Now, a typical baseline CO2 for the average person is around 40 millimeters of mercury pressure. That's just the unit that we put on it.
Okay.
And these guys were showing a CO2 level of up to 44 millimeters of mercury pressure. Now, that's really high. So just you guys listening, if this is the first time you've had any discussion about CO2 or CO2 tolerance, a shift of 1 to 2 millimeters of mercury will throw you into a massive stress response. It's a big deal when CO2 elevates in the body. You don't usually handle it without conditioning yourself. And so these guys were handling a change of 4 to 5 millimeters of mercury, almost double what we typically would respond to negatively. They were taking it without any problem. Now, what is the benefit of being able to improve your CO2 tolerance? I think that's a big concept too, since that's sort of what we're always encouraging endurance runners to train. Get better at your CO2 tolerance, and the result will be less breathlessness, less fatigue, improved aerobic capacity, all those things that an endurance runner really wants, more efficient breathing. So CO2 is your driver to breathe. So any listener who still thinks you're breathing to get more oxygen into your body, let's clear it up right now. So you are breathing to expel off CO2. You're breathing to get rid of the CO2. Why? Because CO2 is really uncomfortable in the body. It's the stimulus to breathe. So as CO2 starts to elevate in the blood, it sends a signal to your brain. And it's usually a warning signal. You know, it feels like a little bit of stress. You usually feel it in your body as air hunger or breathlessness or like, I want to take a breath, right? Mm-hmm. And so that drives us to exhale, and then the blood gases balance out and we go back to breathing. Now, the problem is that through our lifestyle, through our diet, through a lot of different things, a lot of people have adapted to this baseline CO2 level that is much too low. So when I said the average CO2 level for most people is around 40 millimeters, some people, maybe it's only 36 or 38, so it's low, which means they cannot allow any sensation of elevated CO2 in their body without feeling stress, without feeling anxiety. So these are the people who are stuck in a cycle of anxious thinking. Now my breathing is speeding up. I can't tolerate even slowing down my breathing because it makes me too anxious because the CO2 builds up and causes a stress response in my body. I'm sleeping poorly because I can't shut down the mental preoccupation. I'm not getting good quality sleep. I'm stuck in this stress response. I can't get rid of the anxiety. My breathing continues to stay fast and shallow. And so it's a real problem. So if you're a runner and you have anxiety and you have shallow upper chest breathing, it's really going to detract from your performance. So if you can start to shift the CO2 tolerance aspect, so if I have this anxious thought and that starts to influence my breathing by making it a shorter, more shallow upper chest and causes this underlying low-grade stress response, fight or flight response in my body forever, at some point, I have to get in touch with that and say, well, something has to shift because I'm never going to be able to run longer with deeper, slower breaths if I don't correct this. So how do we go about correcting it? It's a good question. It requires slow breathing at rest, right? So a lot of slow deepening the breath at rest. It also requires, sometimes we use breath holds. So breath holding, any type of breath holding that you do is always going to work to improve your CO2 tolerance. So we train certain types of breath holds at rest, seated. But in the Oxygen Advantage, we also train specifically runners how to hold their breath while running. and to kind of play around with breath holds while running, which is, it has a dual effect. So whenever you hold your breath for a long period of time, it helps to open up the airways and open up the nose. So if you're running and you're trying to nasal breathe and you feel like you're not succeeding and you feel courageous about trying to do some breath holds while running, it'll help to open up the nose more and you'll be able to breathe more easily through the nose. Holding your breath after an exhale for a long period of time helps the nasal nitric oxide to pool in the nose so that when you go to take the next inhale, you're bringing more nitric oxide into the lungs, again, making it easier to breathe, opening up the airways, improving the air and blood supply to the alveoli for good gas exchange. I feel like I'm talking a lot, Eric. You want to clarify something?
Okay. you came back to a point that I was going to ask about. The nitric oxide in the blood. Yeah. There's the marketing people say if you drink beet juice, you'll increase your nitric oxide. Does that actually help as well?
So definitely. And I think for sure there's a dietary aspect. So okay. You do have some microbes in your mouth. So if you start to look into, you know, there's a lot of holistic dentists out there now and kind of functional dentistry that's becoming popular. And so there's a lot of talk about the oral microbiome in addition to sort of the gut microbiome that I think is more familiar to us. And so I think there is a certain bacteria in the back of the tongue that is responsible for converting things into this nitric oxide, taking the nitrates from our food and converting them to nitric oxide. And so certain foods like beets, like arugula, a lot of the more dark greens do have the capacity to release nitric oxide into the system. They're a little bit, you know, it's the same thing, but this nasal stuff is something that's happening all the time, regardless of what we're eating. You know, we can always sort of harness that. And, you know, if you don't have that bacteria in your mouth, you know, people who are maybe rinsing a lot with antiseptics in their mouth might be killing off these positive microbes that are doing that job unwittingly without realizing it. Mm-hmm. And so maybe we're not all able to convert that nitrate into nitric oxide as well anymore through our food, but we certainly have that capacity. You know, and nitric oxide is produced in a lot of different cells in the body. Mm-hmm. It's produced in the endothelial cells. That's why it's so healthy for cardiovascular health, right? It really helps to dilate the blood vessels and to keep everything kind of running smoothly.
Right. Because you were talking about it all, you know, in relation to the nasal, and I'm like, okay, is that a marketing ploy? There's a lot of things sold to us to increase your health that I think that don't actually give either if limited benefit or no benefit.
Yeah. I mean, I think the king of nitric oxide is Dr. Louis Signaro. He was sort of one of the guys who won the Nobel Prize for discovering it in 1998. Mm-hmm. And he does actually sell a supplement. It's L-arginine and L-citrulline are these two things he sells in a powder form. So I do know people who take it with good results, but more for cardiovascular
and
health.
whatever, something in relation to that I read on the internet, of course, that there's, it was named the molecule of the year at some point. And I thought,
absolutely.
I didn't even know there was such a thing as a molecule of the year. I thought, who comes up with this? But I mean, it was in relation to how important the molecule was and what the benefits that it was for your overall health.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. So you definitely have that mechanism in your mouth. And, you know, I think like with everything, things change throughout your lifestyle. Maybe you are not able to produce as much with age, but I do believe that the more you continuously practice nasal breathing, the more you can continuously release this nasal nitric oxide without disruption. And so the other big thing, which people always laugh and some people think is nonsense, but when you want to exponentially release nitric oxide is humming, you know? And so this really comes out of ancient sort of yogic practices. You know, they have a certain breath style that includes a humming technique. They call it Brahmari Pranayama. Now in the West, we've sort of borrowed it and simplified it, and we just hum. We just teach humming, basically, a humming breath. And, you know, so in some ways, it's a little bit maybe irreverent or like, you know, we've sort of taken it and simplified it, and we've forgotten some of the finer details that maybe some of the old gurus would say are so critical, but the research really shows that just humming purely on its own really can produce up to 15 times more nasal nitric oxide in the nose that you can then take into your lungs, which is pretty cool. So for people who want to practice that, you literally just inhale through the nose, and on your exhale, it's just a hum as long as you can without hurting your throat, just a sustained hum. And actually, anytime we extend the exhale like that, it also has the benefit of activating more of a parasympathetic response in the body, really helping to get you to get into rest and recovery, a more calm mindset. So there's lots of little tricks that we can do to stimulate all these things in the body.
So you talked a little bit about holding, and then and also I think you were kind of brushing against slowing down your breath rate during the day, but then also during exercise. So what is the advantage, I guess, to trying to slow down your breath rate when you're exercising?
I hear you. So again, you know, it's going to be a little bit of a fine point for each runner because you do have to meet your metabolic needs. But at the same time, like I said, a lot of us are chronically overbreathing and wasting energy doing so. So, you know, some of this is also going to take playing around with your heart rate monitors and seeing what's happening for you, right? And also knowing there's going to be this ugly period of adaptation where things mm-hmm. might not go great, but no, it's worth it in the end. So slowing down the breathing, the biggest thing, the number one was the energy thing, right? So the more we're breathing, the more energy it takes, and we're wasting oxygen, we're wasting ATP, and it could be better utilized in other ways. And then the second thing is going back to this idea of those little air sacs again, the alveoli. So when you slow down your breath, it improves what we call alveolar ventilation, which is just the ability to bring more air to those little air sacs so that they can actually participate in gas exchange. So a slower breath allows the air to come in more deeply to the lung, really fill up the entire lung, and there's more chance for the alveoli scattered throughout all the lung to get access to this air to actually participate in gas exchange and oxygen uptake. And if you look at the formulas, you know, this is not a visual podcast, but when I teach my students in my workshops, we always drive this home. I have a formula that I show them and I say, okay, if this was your respiratory rate and this was your tidal volume, meaning the amount of air you're taking in per breath, how many liters of air are you taking into your body per minute? And then we show how many of those liters actually reach the alveoli. And I think that really drives home for people the difference between just taking air in and out of your body and kind of recycling it and not utilizing it and wasting a lot of energy versus taking that air in and really making good use of it. And the way you make best use of it is by slowing down your breath. In fact, even if you can't reduce your tidal volume, meaning how much breath you're taking in per breath, how much air per breath, by greatly reducing your speed and even taking in more air per breath, the ventilation to the alveoli is just like above and beyond. There's no competition. Mm-hmm. The upper chest breathing is completely inefficient, and you're not even reaching the alveoli in this case. So you're using all this energy to taking mm-hmm. air. Like, I'm getting exhausted just doing those few seconds of that, right? It's exhausting. You're taking all of this air and you're just recycling it through what we call sort of like the conducting tubes of the respiratory tract, but you're not really getting it into the functional part of the lung where it can do its job. So slowing down the breath is huge.
So, yeah, and you talked about two things. You can slow down the breath and keep the same volume. Mm-hmm. You can also reduce the volume.
Yep.
So, but slowing down and reducing the volume probably is the one of the probably the best.
It's going to be the trickiest running. So number one, when running, try to slow it down. Mm-hmm. That's what I would say. So try to get it through your nose in and out and try to slow down the breathing. And so when you first start nasal breathing and slowing down the breath, you're probably going to have to slow down your speed at first. You're not going mm-hmm. to be running at the same speed, you know, and use your heart rate monitor sometimes, you know, like whatever heart rate you normally feel comfortable at. If you're mouth breathing at that heart rate, okay, now shut your mouth and see how that heart rate feels for you. Does it feel too intense to continue at that speed for 5 or 10 minutes or at that heart rate for 5 or 10 minutes, breathing in and out through your nose? If the answer is yes, all right, slow it down a little bit. Let the heart rate drop a little bit and see if you can run 5, 10 minutes just nasal breathing. Like, where is that threshold for you? And then use that as your baseline marker. And for the next 2 months, every time you go out for a run, you try to either increase the heart rate a little bit or you try to run longer at that sort of baseline comfort zone till you're really just breathing in and out through the nose the whole time as consistently as possible. And you're slowing down the breath. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense?
Yes. Yes. And, and the, all of the things you're saying, it was like, it's great. I've kind of put this into practice and so, yeah, I can verify that, that it is possible when I thought that it wasn't. So
have you converted to nasal breathing fully during your runs?
Yes.
Wow. Great.
I haven't gotten into winter yet. And so when I first heard about this, it was still cold mm-hmm. and you know, you talked about warming the air. I was so used to breathing that I could run mouth breathing at 6 below 0 and not, wow. and not, and didn't feel any, I mean, you know, my thought was, yeah, who needs the air to be warm? You know, I'm doing fine.
Right.
And so when it was a Qi running class that they were talking about breathing through the nose, I thought, well, I'll try it. And it was 40 degrees out. It just burned my nasal cavity. And so, cause I wasn't adapted to it. So I thought, okay, I'll wait till the weather warms up and really, really give it a go. And so as the weather gets colder, I'm kind of, you know, hoping that my body will adapt to the temperature change. So
I think it will. You've been adapting for almost a year now. I think you're going to be in great shape. That's cool. Awesome. Yeah. And so did you have any other negative repercussions when you first switched? You know, a lot of people, for me, I know with my own practice, it's like the mucus buildup, right? Every time I exhale, it's like so much mucus is coming out. So a lot of people, we have chronically, you know, kind of stuffed sinuses, mm-hmm. stuffed nasal passages. So I always tell people to run with some kind of hanky or something when they're first starting this practice, because you're going to be blowing out mucus for sure. I mean, it's unavoidable.
Well, I mean, you're New York City, so I can trail runners have what we call snot rockets.
Okay, so perfect.
We don't use hankies.
Yeah, you're not shy about it. You just blow it out. I got you.
Yeah, and especially, you know, when the weather gets colder, you know, you kind of you have to be aware of kind of who's around you and like nobody's coming by you on the trail when you do that.
Snot is a real problem. It's a problem.
and that's, you know, for mouth. I mean, I had that when I was mouth breathing as well. So, we'll see. But no.
Well, when you were mouth breathing though, was it coming from the lungs or from the nose?
No, it was always through the nose. I mean, well, it came out the nose. So, I mean, when there was a stuffiness in the nose and it was like, you know, uncomfortable enough, even though I was using my mouth to breathe. So.
Right, right. Well, and that's the other thing, you know, like with anything in anatomy and physiology, we say use it or lose it, right? I mean, it applies to everything. So if you're really never using your nose fully during your runs or during any aspect of your life, of course, the functioning is going to be stifled a little bit, right? You have to mm-hmm. regain full functioning. For sure.
Yeah. Not a negative reaction. It was actually a positive. My sense of smell became much, nice. Much better just because I was, I began noticing that. It took some work, I ran out in Arizona 2 weeks ago. The Javelina. It was a 20-mile trail race and a lot more dust than what I was used to. And I really felt like I really was kind of glad that I wasn't breathing. Yeah. I mean, I could tell the difference just in the environment.
Definitely. For sure.
I'm not a front of the pack competitive runner. I was able to, you know, do most of my breathing through my nose, even going uphill, even hard breathing.
Awesome.
And so, I've done a little bit of experimenting with breathing out through my mouth on the exhale. Mm-hmm. Just, again, you know, talking about how your body adapts to the metabolic needs, and I realized that it's probably limiting. You know, it's kind of like a governor that mm-hmm. some of the hills I was not able to go as fast as I wanted to going up, and so I started experimenting with breathing in through my nose, out through my mouth. To get that carbon dioxide out a little bit faster. And so, but I mean, you talked about carbon dioxide tolerance. That's some of the things I've been working on. So, I've noticed a huge difference.
I think that's awesome. And I think that's an important point you just brought up, because as you go through this process, you don't want to chastise yourself for breathing through the mouth, right? You know, like it's not the end of the world. This is a process and it's not the end all and be all. Like you're trying it, you're experimenting, you're seeing how it works for you. And that's the perfect example. So you hit this hill and you need it a little bit more just juice to get up it, and that you couldn't tolerate that elevated CO2 in the system anymore, and you kept the inhale through the nose and now you're blowing off a little bit extra through the mouth. It's fine. You're trying to find how you can meet your metabolic needs. It's totally fine, you know, and the more you train that hill, you might find that you could do the whole hill, you know, nasal breathing in and mm-hmm. out. But I think that's perfect. And I think it's like we need to make that comment so that, because runners, I know your ultra marathon runners have to be perfectionists. And so, you know, and I'm a perfectionist too, and perfectionists tend to be really kind of like rigid about their breathing or about their tools for performance, right? We're like, someone tells us to do it this way, we're going to do it this way, and we're going to make sure it's right, you know? So I think it's nice to give permission to people to say, you know, like, it doesn't have to be perfect. This is a game that you're playing and you're just trying the best that you can. And you will find where you need to make the adaptations for sure.
And the other thing that you mentioned and that I would kind of wanted to highlight is the fact of making it a practice that is not kept to either running or meditating, that is a focus that goes with you throughout the day. And that's one of the things that I do in my coaching as well is that I have adapted for myself. Any habit, anything that you want to change in your life, it can't be something you work on for a little while and then just go off and do what you were doing before.
100%.
I started practicing qi running and qi walking.
Nice.
And incorporating the changing the way that I walk. I mean, I wasn't running everywhere, but it was the same process of learning how to walk differently. Mm. When you've been walking for all of your life, I mean, you adapt, you know, until you hit whatever size you are as an adult, you're adapting your walking style or your running style all the way up because your body is changing in the way. And so you adapt, and that's what you do, and you don't have to think about it. And it's totally subconscious. There's never. And so when I'd get up and walk across the room, I would have to go, okay. You know, I had to stop myself and say, okay, you know, center your balance, you know, where are you at? And it was a daily practice. And that for anything that is worthwhile, that, you know, if you're trying to make some sort of major, you know, adjustment to who you are, you know, there's a mental component to that of like, okay, I have to stop doing it the way I've always done out of habit without thinking. Mm-hmm. And you have to stop yourself and say, okay, you know, I'm doing it differently now. It's huge. And it's, I did the same thing with the breathing and it's not easy. And, you know, and I know there are a lot of, one of my running friends says, well, I just run. I don't want to think about how I breathe. I'm like, okay, well, that, I mean, that's good. And I know there are people who do that, but I mean, for you and I, at least, we want to have a consciousness about how we live our life and the kind of life we have. And so, it's not hard. It's not, but it takes focus and it takes that paying attention. I lived a lot of my life with, you know, just kind of going with the flow and just kind of taking the easy way. And it got me to a place I really didn't want to be. And when I got there, I was like, okay, you know, how do I change this? And so it's like, all I have to do is think different. Well, yeah. but there's more to it than that.
Yeah, I mean, I just call it pattern interruption, you know? I mean, that's everything. Humans are collections of patterns. We have movement patterns. We have breathing patterns. We have eating patterns. We have emotional response patterns. We have thought patterns. You know, it's like just one pattern on top of the other. You're not going to change them all at once. Or maybe you change one and it precipitates changing all the others, but you just start changing one thing. And I love what you said, like commit to making this one change for the next 2 to 3 weeks and just stick to that change for now and see what other changes come from it. Because as soon as you start to get sort of that positive feedback again, that positive feedback loop that reinforces, oh, this was a good change, I'm going to keep doing this, and now maybe I also want to take it to the next level, I think it's really important. But definitely with your breathing, like I said, you've got to give it at least, for this full transition to nasal breathing, at least 2 to 3 months. Be realistic with yourself. Mm-hmm. Realize the first 2 to 3 weeks are probably going to be painful and uncomfortable, and you're going to have to find strategies. I also say don't overtax yourself. If it is really burning to nasal breathe, do it for a few minutes, take a break. Do it for a few minutes, take a break. You don't want to cause inflammation to the nasal mucosa in the practice of trying to improve nasal breathing. You know, it's counter effective. So, you know, really just be honest with yourself and be, you know, it's like a little bit of a humbling experience to make the transition. And if you want to do it, then There's tools to do it. Many people have done it, and you can absolutely do it. Yeah. And if it's not interesting
to
you,
it is worth
it. It's okay.
Yeah. And it is worth the effort. I mean, I can see it was one of the things that that I thought, is this really going to be worth it in the end? And it's made a difference for me. So
yeah,
thank you a lot for being here. Tell people how they can find you. I know you have a lot of resources online, I would like to be able to direct people to be able to get some if they wanted to make some changes along with breathing to get connected with you. And I think there might be other things you could offer as well. So how do they get connected with you?
Yeah, awesome. So I'd love to connect with anyone and everyone who's interested. My main website, and it's a little bit tricky, is belighttt.com. So that's BELIGH3Ts.com. My company is BeLight Transformative Therapy. If you go to belighttt.com/6-days, I have a totally free breath training up on my website. It's called the Breath Basics 6-Day Challenge. And it's such a nice introduction to just basic breathing principles and how they affect our physiology, our mood, our mental state, our emotional state, our nervous system. That is a 15-minute video tutorial that you get access to once a day for 6 days. It gives you what's the breath technique we're going to do? Why is it beneficial? How do we do it? And then you get a 5-minute breath practice every day, a guided breath practice. So that's a really nice segue into breathing if you guys have never done any type of breath work before. I also, every month to 2 months, run a new 4-week breath boot camp. And so you can find that at belighttt.com/bootcamp. That is a paid service, but it's an awesome 4-week deep dive. It's a live workshop experience. We meet once a week for about an hour and a half to 2 hours, diving into breathing physiology, theory, exercises. I run you guys through what I call a breath gym every time. We have breath gym classes throughout the week, which are like a 45-minute class. So there's a lot of support, motivation, accountability. There's a private community that goes with that and a lot of other fun bonuses. So that is my biggest recommendation for people who are really serious about getting into breathing, how it affects their daily activity, how it affects their performance, how it affects their sleep. That's a really great program. And then my YouTube channel, which is youtube.com/BeLightTT. So BeLight with 3 T's. I put up a lot of free educational stuff, a lot of stuff on breathing, lots of guided breath sessions, as well as breathing tutorials that just go into more of these topics in more detail, and maybe with a greater organization of thought than me just stream of consciousness spewing it out at you guys. So, yeah.
Well, this has been a fun conversation, and I'll have all of those links in the notes, the show notes for this.
So. Awesome, I appreciate it.
Hey, thanks for listening to this episode of the Ultramarathon Mindset Podcast. You know, the breath work that Tara teaches, it has changed my running, and I'm seeing positive results in my body as well related to the mindset work that I do. If you've listened to this podcast very long, you know the theme that I really kind of get on is there is a relationship between your mind and your body. Mindset work is not just what you think. There's also a physical component as well. And for ultimate performance and health, whether it's running in life, getting your mind and body on the same page is rather important. And breath work is kind of an integral part of help making that happen. So I hope that you enjoyed this what Tara had to say, and would look into what she has to offer and check out some of her free stuff that she offers online. It will make a difference. I know that it will from experience. Remember, we have a site for leaving comments. So if you'd like to comment on this episode or any other episode, it is at ultramindsetpodcast.run. You can leave comments, questions, or stories. If you have a running story you'd like to share, we'll be glad to put it on at the end of the podcast episode after I'm done talking here. Also, the show notes for this episode and all the rest of the episodes are there at the same link, ultramindsetpodcast.run. Thanks for listening. Remember, an ultramarathon mindset is about more than just running. And if you're feeling stuck and would like to have somebody help you kind of get an outside perspective, encourage you, see what goals you would like to set and achieve, send me a DM on Instagram at Eric Dieter, or you can use the link here, ultramindsetpodcast.run. You can send text or voice message. I'd be glad to see if I can help you. Thanks again for listening. I'll see you next time.